I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio.
This is the first half of my interview with Max Moore, one of the founders of contemporary transhumanism. You can find the second half of the interview at ieet.org.
I'm speaking today with Max Moore. Max is one of the founders of transhumanism, coiner of the contemporary use of that term, and he calls himself a strategic philosopher. I want to talk a little bit about your history, Max, because some of my listeners might not be familiar with your pivotal role. Can you tell us a little bit about when you first came to the States and how the whole extropy thing got started?
Yeah, actually, I have to go back a year before I came to the States permanently, to 1986. I actually came over in 87 to do my graduate work at University of Southern California, a PhD in philosophy. But the year before that, I came over for 6 weeks. I had, earlier in 1986, sent a donation to the Alcor Life Extension Foundation for some cryonics appeal. I don't remember the details. And the person running the organization at that time, Mike Darwin, had said, hey, if you're willing to send us some money 6,000 miles away, how about actually stepping up to a challenge and starting an organization in England? And so that's exactly what I did, along with Mike Tyson, Garrett Smith, and a couple of people, and decided that summer to come out to the States for several weeks and stay at Alcor and learn the procedures. And after that, I brought back to England a big box of drugs, which people always thought was rather odd when they came into my room at university, and a heart-lung resuscitator. And we actually got an amazing amount of publicity that summer, and I left in the middle of that towards the end of August to come over to USC, having done the Terry Wogan show, which I guess at that time was the equivalent in those days of, I forget the name of it, the big American talk show back when it was popular, BBC World Service, and a whole bunch of other things. And so I left in the middle of that and came over to the States. And during that time in 86 and before, we'd been putting out a newsletter called Biostasis, which was kind of a forerunner to the magazine Extropy. We started putting out in 1988. In there, we discussed life extension, but also space colonization, intelligence increase, and other related proto-transhumanist topics. And so I think that was kind of a predecessor to Extropy magazine, which I, along with my friend Tom, as grad students at USC, started putting together. And the idea of Extropy was, the term we used as a metaphor for loosely the converse of entropy, whereas entropy is in a closed system, things tending towards disorder and decay and falling apart, less usable energy and so forth. Extropy was a metaphor for increased intelligence, information, usable energy, complexity, and all the good stuff in that, basically. And we used that as a metaphor for our magazine, again, with the core elements being interested in life extension, getting outside the gravity well of the planet, improving our intelligence, and generally challenging all the limits to human nature, really the essence, I think, of the idea of transhumanism. And that's how Extropy magazine got started. And
There's a lot more involved in that magazine than just life extension. So where did all those other ideas come from? I mean, was there just a zeitgeist at the time that you were absorbing? Or, you know, where did the space exploration and all that other stuff, were you a big reader of science fiction and these ideas were coming from there? Or?
Well, you know, that's, I often get asked that question. I'm never quite sure exactly of what the right answer is. As far as I can tell, there's some kind of mutant in terms of ideas, because I can't really explain it by my background, except perhaps that I read very widely at a very early age. I do remember that I was fascinated with space travel from a very early age. I watched the Apollo 11 moon landing when I was 5 years old and insisted on watching everyone after that. Everybody else seemed to have lost interest. So I was fascinated by that. And of course, I read superhero comics from when I was about 9 or 10 onwards, I suppose. So there are other elements of the idea of overcoming fundamental human limits in a more fantasy form. And I also became interested from around 10 or 11 years old with psychic phenomena and the occult, before I developed any real critical thinking powers. But again, I think it appealed to me, this idea of overcoming human limits in some form. So those are some possible sources which somehow came together as we started getting more interested in science and technology in general. This core idea of overcoming limits. We've always assumed that we're going to die at a certain age, that we're stuck on this planet, that we're stuck with the brains that we have, the behaviors we've always enacted throughout human history, which includes a lot of destructive behaviors. And somehow those all started coming together with the idea that maybe we should be challenging those fundamental limits. And I think that's really what led into the concept of extropy.
From the beginning, you described extropianism or extropy as a set of transhumanist philosophies, acknowledging that there are other possible transhumanist philosophies out there. And where did the idea of calling it that the general class of ideas, transhumanism, come from? There were a couple historical predecessors, Julian Huxley and Abraham Maslow had used the term in a different context. So were you inspired by any of those to use this term, or was it de novo?
Although there were earlier uses, I wasn't actually familiar with those uses. I think I might have read some Maslow. I'm not sure when I first read him, but I hadn't read his use of the term transhuman, and I was more familiar with his various stages of needs and so on, and this positive psychology. I didn't come across Huxley until much later. In fact, I hadn't actually read his book, New Bottles for New Wine, in which he uses the term transhumanism. I only read that actually very recently. I'm still not entirely clear what he meant by that. He said the human species can, if it wishes, transcend itself, and suggested we need a term for that. He says transhumanism will serve man remaining man, but transcending himself by realizing new possibilities of and for his human nature. That leaves it pretty vague as to what he meant by that, whether he actually was talking about a fundamental transformation of biologically grounded nature. One suspects he might have been thinking that way, given his obviously expertise in science. But he doesn't really explicitly state that, whether he's thinking more of improving our behavior beyond our historical tendencies. But I certainly haven't heard of Huxley's use at that time. I think, for me, it was more an outgrowth of humanist ideals. I was fascinated by the Enlightenment and humanism and its emphasis on the ideas of progress and use of reason and science and technology backed by simply goodwill to improve humanity itself. It just seemed to me, though, that reading the humanist materials of the day, from the past up to the present, humanists actually have become very conservative, not in the political sense, but in the sense that although they wanted to ameliorate the human condition, they really weren't questioning the human condition itself. What could we do to actually revolutionize that? And so I think that's why I tacked on the trans to humanism. To me, it actually has two interrelated meanings that actually are philosophically separable. You can think of transhumanism, trans-humanism, which is really, I think, the first motivation for me, the fundamental ideas of humanism, progress, science, and so on, but then transcending the human condition. And then there's the idea of transhuman-ism, which is more an emphasis on overcoming fundamental human limits and having abilities, opportunities beyond that.
You were acquaintance of FM 2030, the Iranian futurist who was in the Bay Area out there with you guys, wasn't he, at that time?
I was talking California, in Los Angeles.
You were in Los Angeles. But wasn't FM in the picture someplace? Because he had written these books back in the late 70s about are you a transhuman? And he promoted that particular idea that using technologies to transcend the human would make you a transhuman.
Yeah, FM I didn't meet until, I think, 1990 or something like that. I think I hadn't actually read any of his work until then. I had heard about some of it, I think, through Robert Anton Wilson. In Wilson's books, he'd referred to Timothy Leary's ideas, certain specific ideas of Leary's, which actually were very proto-transhumanist. I think his SMILE formula, SMI2LE, standing for space migration, intelligence, increased life extension. That was kind of a clear proto-transhumanism. And he had mentioned FM, I'm sure. I don't remember the specifics. So I may have come across the term transhuman, but I don't think FM had kind of the same philosophical background, and he didn't really relate it to humanism. So I probably picked up transhuman from him, but added that to the idea of humanism, and that may have emerged later as transhumanism. But I don't really remember actually any specifics of what I heard about FM, apart from, I think, Robert Anton Wilson or Leary perhaps mentioning him as an interesting futurist thinker.
You mentioned the conservatism of humanism. Paul Kurtz, who is one of the dominant features of American humanist life over the last couple decades, had made a big effort to give a political agenda to humanism and atheism, which is slightly different from the classical humanism we're talking about. But there had been a social democratic cast, a liberal left cast to humanism for the most part. That was different from the politics of the set of folks that you started the Extropy Institute with.
Yeah, certainly. Founding Extrapy Magazine and later Extrapy Institute, initially a strong part of the Extrapy way of thinking about things was an emphasis on spontaneous order as opposed to centralized, opposed orders. And in thinking about removing the limits of the gravity well, the limits of the human lifespan, the limits of human intelligence, part of that to me very much was the idea of the limits of the state. That to me, certainly from my teen years, the state was very much part of those constraints. Since then, I've kind of developed a little bit more subtlety in that approach. I don't think the state is always the problem. I think there's more fundamental problems that, regardless of our institutions, thinking problems cause us difficulties. But that was very much a part of it at the time. Humanism, that wasn't really the part of humanism that bothered me, though. It wasn't the political view so much. It was really, I thought, a rather overly comfortable view of the human future, that it was a matter of just making small improvements, a little bit of amelioration of the human condition, rather than actually thinking fundamentally about challenging it. And soon after I wrote, I think the first piece actually with the word transhumanism in the title, apart from Huxley's piece, around 1989 or 90, I did a version of that for Free Inquiry, which I think was the largest humanist magazine at the time, and at the invitation of the editor. And he said they had probably a stronger response to that article than anything they published in his experience at that date. And I asked him about how was the response exactly in terms of pro and con. And he said it was about 50-50 in favor and against. So apparently there are other humanists who felt some dissatisfaction with the rather comfortable nature of modern humanism. On the other half, who were very dug in on the idea that, no, death is good for us, or death is natural and gives life meaning, and we need to accept these limits. So I think it's interesting that humanists who can be quite explicitly and strongly atheistic can actually agree quite strongly with most religious people in defending the idea that death is a good thing, it's part of human nature and should stay that way.
That continues up to the day. There's going to be a conference in December, December 3rd and 4th in Philadelphia, sponsored by the Center for Inquiry, which is a big humanist think tank, part of the Paul Kurtz founded empire. And they're going to focus on these questions of human enhancement, and they're bringing in humanists who are quite anti. So there seems to be a continuing circling of the transhumanist and humanist circles that where they're not entirely comfortable with each other.
Yes, and there's interesting crossovers in other areas. For instance, the Matter Nexus Institute, which seems like a quite interesting group of people willing to explore religious ideas and the interface of religion and science, if there is one, in various different ways. And I've had that somewhat a frustrating experience with them. Initially, they published a volume, becoming a volume, I guess, originally a web collection of essays critical of transhumanism, and then they... thanks to Natasha Vidamore, eventually published some rejoinders, and they're about to publish a book which is combining those called Transhumanism and Its Critics. And an interesting dialogue in Arizona with the editor, I guess, or one of the main leaders of that event, Harvard. And a little bit frustrated seeing the draft of the book that's about to be published. He seems to have ignored everything we discussed last year at the conference, talking about transhumanists as if we all share certain views, even though I clearly disabused her of that idea. Was the idea that we're all utilitarians and we have no concept of virtue, something which I disputed. Clearly, Nick Bostrom and David Pierce are strong utilitarians. I'm not and never have been. I'm more of a virtue theorist kind of guy, although I don't think any of the major meta-ethical theories are adequate on their own. But she also seemed to think we were just basically bad people, horrible people, lacking in virtue. And it seems to be pushing that same line as if we never discussed anything since then.
Well, Hava is a conservative Jewish historian and philosopher, and that project that she ran out there at University of Arizona, Arizona State rather, was funded by the Templeton Foundation, which has been promoting these religion and science convergence type projects. And I think that they're, just as the humanists are conflicted about whether transhumanism may be a little bit too religious or visionary for their taste, the religious are certainly conflicted because, on the one hand, we engage with visionary ideas of human transcendence that are pretty close to religion, but on the other hand, that may be quite threatening to them. That we may be a substitute, promote ourselves as a substitute for religion. And I think that's certainly Hava comes down on we're false religion kind of folks as far as she's concerned.
Yes, this is interesting because, as you say, she's Jewish, I guess conservative Jewish, and of course Leon Kass also kind of stands out for. He wrote a piece in which he complained about other Jewish scholars apparently not being terribly upset by transhumanism. I think it's a piece called The Ham, something about how...
Right, about how death is good. Yeah.
Yeah. But that's curious, because I just came back last week. I gave the latest, and I've given a number of talks to a Jewish high school in Los Angeles, and I just came back last week from doing that. And I've always had a very good reception there. I was invited by the biology teacher there, who also teaches a special science class by the students. And it's always a great pleasure for me to, even though it's a bit of a distance to travel, I always agree to go over there, even though I'm no longer in the area, because these students are very open, they're very interested in these ideas, and the teachers I've met there don't seem at all hostile. So it seems to me that the Jewish tradition, despite what Hava and Leon Katz seem to be arguing, doesn't seem particularly hostile to transhumanist ideas. Especially because they don't really say anything much about an afterlife that's being left open to people's particular beliefs. And clearly the Jewish tradition has a strong history of improving things and of questioning things, and a lot of great thinkers in the Jewish tradition. And they even have ideas of the golem, which I guess you could see as a kind of early form of robotics in a way, a mystical robotics, if you like.
Well, Leon Kass and the conservative Jews who are opposed to transhumanism do have an uphill battle, because within Judaism, anything that extends life and anything that extends fertility is considered a mitzvah, a blessing. And so it's really hard for them to argue that you should embrace natural limits to life or reject technologies, fertility-enhancing technologies that we tend to promote. So that's exactly why he wrote that L'chaim. He's saying, yeah, okay, we're for life, but we're not for that much life.
Right. There has to be limits, after all. Too much of a good thing. Yeah.
Right.
It does seem that Judaism and it seems that Mormonism are probably the two most sympathetic religious traditions, most compatible with the transhumanist ideas. Although I can really see that other religious traditions, apart from more fundamentalist varieties, could make room for us without too much trouble. And I've taught a lot of Catholic students, and I study Catholicism and have quite a bit of respect for Thomas Aquinas in various ways, especially his Aristotelian aspects. And I can see how Catholics might actually come around to some transhumanist ideas in the long run. They have actually managed to change their ideas. They've apologized for Galileo, and they've admitted evolution is okay with them, is now compatible. So I can see Catholicism coming around and more liberal Protestantism. Of course, fundamentalist Protestantism is another matter, and I think Islam might be a trouble. But for the most part, I don't see religion being necessarily compatible with transhumanist ideas. As we're seeing, both you and I are speaking at a conference next month organized by Mormons who seem to be very clearly transhumanist. They seem a little bit unusual for Mormons, as far as I can tell, being apparently atheistic, and I'm not really sure what they believe about the origins of their religion. Since that was based on revelation, I don't quite understand that. But they seem to be very compatible and very enthusiastic about transhumanist ideas.
Well, this is part of the conundrum of the relationship of transhumanist ideas and religion for me is that, as you emphasized when you started Extropy Institute, the importance of critical reason and that legacy from the Enlightenment of trying to put everything through the sieve of critical reason doesn't permit a faith-based or revelation-based faith orientation. But on the other hand, there are a lot of ideas about human transcendence and the ultimate possibilities of the universe that fulfill various aspects of the eschatological and soteriological visions of religions. And so there's, if they pick and choose among transhumanism, they can find things that are compatible. And if we pick and choose among religion, we can find some things that are compatible and we could have that conversation. But in the end, it's a pretty difficult relationship still.
Yes, it is. I think the thing is about human beings, as I've come to appreciate more and more over the years, is that we are extremely inconsistent thinkers. We're very good at putting different conflicting ideas into different compartments of our brain. That, I think, is one of the fundamental problems of human nature, which overcoming it will be tricky and difficult and probably dangerous. But in the long run, I think it's something we'll have to tackle, is this ability to really hold belief A and a belief C, which implies something contradictory to A. And that seems to be the thing with religion. Now, maybe that's a good thing in a way, in that it does allow religious people who fundamentally accept revelation and non-rational ideas to actually get behind some of the clearly beneficial ideas in transhumanism. But in the long run, I think it's going to also put some impediments up to progress. If you just cannot resolve something based on evidence and facts and reason and argument, if it's going to come down in the end to a belief that my prophet says so-and-so, then I think we have a fundamental inconsistency with
Go ahead.
I don't know the views of these particular Mormons. They seem to be rationalists as far as I can tell. But it'd be interesting to find out more about that aspect of their beliefs.
Yeah, well, I don't consider the foundations of Mormon faith to be terribly different from the foundations of Christian faith. I mean, the notion of a virgin birth inspired by God, you know, doesn't upset me any more or less than the notion of Joseph Smith having been visited by the angel Moroni and given golden tablets and all of that. But, just as there are Catholics, you know, I'm a Buddhist. And as a Buddhist, I don't believe any of the superstitious aspect of Buddhism, and I still find a lot to value in the mythopoetic heritage of that tradition and the philosophical ideas of that tradition. So if they have that approach, that sufficiently critical post-Enlightenment approach to Mormonism, then, you know, God bless them, as they say. But we'll have to just see when we get out there.
Right.
So I wanted to go back to what you were saying about virtue theory, because my first book, Citizen Cyborg, was all about politics. But the second book that's long simmering and hopefully will come to fruition someday is Cyborg Buddha. And the way that I've structured the book and framed the book is around virtue theory, which was a surprise to me when it finally dawned that this was the natural way to do it. Because I had always considered myself a utilitarian. And when I started to look at the questions around how enhancement technologies might influence and affect our capacity for moral virtue, then virtue theory just, you know, became the obvious framework for thinking about those things. But you weren't originally a virtue theorist. As I understand it, you were a little bit more inspired by Nietzsche or some ideas. It doesn't seem like virtue was always a part of your...
Well, actually, I regard Nietzsche as a virtue theorist. I mean, he's very vague and inconsistent. It's really hard to pin him down on anything. But I think at least in some broad sense, he's a virtue theorist. He's interested in the kind of people we can become and overcoming humanity, challenging moral rules. I think he really despised utilitarianism. That was very clear. He had harsh words to say about Jeremy Bentham of utilitarians. I think he's looking towards what, you know, in his mind was a more noble vision of what humanity could be. And his mission, I don't necessarily agree in all the details, maybe that's rather harsh, but he did have an idea of a higher being, something better than we can become, better than we are, that we can become. So I think he was, in a broad sense, a virtue theorist. And I don't think I can say I've identified with any other moral theory before that. I was probably undecided early on, but I never really found utilitarianism appealing at all. It always seemed to me to turn us into moral slaves who had to continually maximize some variable, depending on which particular version of it was, if it's pleasure or happiness or joy or knowledge in various other forms, or in the case of GE Moore, beauty. And I was really didn't see the motivation. Why should I go around maximizing some value that I'm being told is the intrinsic good? Nor have I felt any appeal towards any kind of deontological ethics like Immanuel Kant. It always seemed like something that appeals to mathematicians, using some kind of formula to decide which actions are consistent with a moral rule. That to me has always seemed appealing to try to understand ourselves, understand how we could be better, how we could improve our moral character. And I've always certainly found Aristotle appealing, his idea of virtue as something that you have to practice and work on, and that should be based on some idea of character, not really personality, but character. So I guess I've always been a virtue, at least I've felt the theory, and once I really understood the differences between them, I've always been pretty sympathetic to that. And I think Nietzsche probably was, at least.
I've been teaching a course on happiness and public policy the last couple of years here at Trinity, and one of the inspirations, of course, was this course where I was trying to think about the ways that happiness and virtue relate and then how enhancement technology fits into all that. And I think that one of the things that's made me more interested in virtue theory is thinking about utilitarianism in the context of enhancement technologies, David Pierce's humanist, hedonist imperative and those kinds of things. Really shows the weakness of pursuing utilitarianism in the future. In other words, if we have the capacity at some point to create chemical pleasure, chemical happiness for ourselves, there would be a pretty sterile land of the lotus eaters interpretation of the good life. And you have to go back to something like Aristotle's eudaimonia to have a more full notion of what a fully realized human personality could be other than simply jacking in and being chemically happy all the time.
Right, yeah, this idea of wire headings we've seen in science fiction that the idea you could make yourself be happy regardless of what you like or what you accomplish, that certainly does seem very sterile to me, not something inspiring or worth reaching for. You mentioned Aristotle's idea of eudaimonia, this kind of idea of moral excellence through actual practice and developing oneself and training oneself. I think, you know, I can understand why, given the utilitarian view, you couldn't really have an objection to plugging yourself in to be perpetually happy regardless of effort. But as Robert Nozick argued in his thought experiment on the dream machine, I personally would much rather actually do something in reality, better myself, better the world, rather than just think I had or feel like I had or feel like I deserve to feel good for no particular reason. I'm not sure I can give a fundamental argument that that's the right way to look at things, but that's definitely the way I do look at things.
Now, you mentioned Nozick, and certainly there are examples of virtue theorists or neo-Aristotelians who are classical liberals. But in general, people who are attracted to that line of reasoning do not end up libertarians, because the libertarian notion is that no one should judge anybody else's idea of happiness and the good life, and that we shouldn't have any publicly articulated goals about whether it's better to read Plato than to lie in the gutter and take heroin. So is that one of the reasons why you have drifted away from a stricter form of anarcho-capitalist libertarianism?
No, I don't think so. It's not that I've become like Alistair MacIntyre, thinking that virtue implies some kind of role for government. I still do strongly advocate a separation between any kind of moral ideal and government. I think government has a role in taking care of certain public goods. I think that markets can't well provide any particular time in history, depending on the level of technology and transaction costs and so on. That's really my reason for thinking there is a role for government. It's not really to do with virtue. I'd actually be fairly horrified at government promoting any particular concept of virtue. So I don't think that's really a motivation for that, no. Well, I should mention that in the extropic view of transhumanism, the kind of the principles of extropy, there's a strong building in of this idea of perpetual progress. And in my original article on transhumanism, I tried to express that idea that the meaningfulness of a life doesn't depend on reaching some kind of final goal which will produce ultimate happiness. To me, meaningfulness of life actually involves a continual perpetual progress, perpetual transcendence. Once we achieve one goal, we want to move on to the next. It's that process that actually gives us a meaning in life. But I found not everybody thinks that way. You know, for instance, discussing that on an email list with Philip Van Nidevel, he was he couldn't understand that view at all. He found that he was quite taken aback and said, how on earth can you believe that nonsense? Of course we have to reach a goal, otherwise nothing has meaning. But I think the problem with that view is once you do reach that goal, what is there left to do? I guess then you do just plug yourself in and make yourself feel good.
This has been the first half of my interview with Max Moore, one of the founders of contemporary transhumanism. For the second half of the interview, go to ieet.org.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IEET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IEET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@ieet.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at ieet.org. You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to archive.org. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.